The Federal News Update for Wednesday, January 7, 2026. Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide through the source material. And today we have a monumental stack of government activity to get through.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, and I'm ready to help break down this, you know, really overwhelming volume of decisions and rules that have crossed the federal apparatus in just the last 48 hours.
Sam, the mission today feels more critical than usual. We really need to create an exhaustive archival record of what happened during this January 6th and 7th operational window.
Mm-hmm.
Our sources are framing this period not as just, you know, business as usual, but as a definitive inflection point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that phrase, definitive inflection point, I think is really well chosen. The sources all characterize these 48 hours as being defined by this simultaneous aggressive expansion of executive authority.
Across what domains?
Across everything, foreign, economic, and military domains. And what seems to link all these actions together, I mean, from claiming Greenland to rewriting the tax code, is this underlying philosophy.
The hyper-sovereigntist America First doctrine.
Exactly. It's an administration that seems to be fundamentally redefining American power and moving, you know, much faster and more unilaterally than we've ever tracked before.
Okay, so to get through all this, we've structured this deep dive into three major tiers. We'll start with the explosive actions of the executive branch.
Yeah.
The big geopolitical moves and the fiscal changes that go with them.
Right.
Then we'll move to the legislative branch, looking at the friction there, the really narrow battles over confirmations and deregulation.
And then we'll finish with the judicial branch, because they're applying some crucial constitutional checks, especially some of these new Supreme Court rulings that are already, you know, setting boundaries on that executive power.
It's a huge volume of material.
It is, but we're going to be methodical. We'll get every detail, every number.
All right, let's start with that aggressive expansion.
Yeah.
Right at the top, where the hard power is being projected, the White House and the National Security Council. The tone seems to be set by that recent military action in Venezuela.
Absolutely. The tone is now clearly defined by a willingness to use hard power for, you know, territorial and resource security, and to do it while explicitly ignoring the old diplomatic norms.
And that takes us straight to the Arctic. On January 6th, the administration made it formal. The idea of acquiring Greenland from Denmark is no longer a fantasy.
No, it's now an immediate national security imperative. That's the official language.
And the language they used was very specific, wasn't it? It seemed designed to pivot this whole thing from a negotiation into a direct confrontation.
It was. The White House press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, confirmed that President Trump is weighing a range of options to get it done.
Okay, what was the exact justification and what was the specific phrase that really escalated the threat?
So the stated rationale is purely geostrategic. They said it's necessary to deter our adversaries in the Arctic region, and they specifically named Russia and China. But the real escalation, the line that changed everything, was when Leavitt said, and this is a direct quote, utilizing the U.S. military is always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal.
Wow. Okay, that one phrase completely changes the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a real estate deal anymore.
Not at all.
It's invoking Article 2 commander-in-chief powers to potentially just seize territory. What does that signal to a NATO ally like Denmark?
Well, it signals a profound willingness to just break with all precedent. And this was reinforced by Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller. He came out and said it is the formal position of the U.S. government that Greenland should be part of the U.S.
And he added something else, didn't he?
He did. He added the, you know, really chilling calculation that nobody would fight the United States over it, which suggests that the West Wing believes our European allies are just too dependent on the U.S. security umbrella to do anything about it.
They think dependency outweighs any kind of diplomatic outrage.
That seems to be the calculation, yes.
So the why behind this?
Mm-hmm.
It's more than just territory. It's about strategic depth, securing the GIUK gap, and crucially, access to mineral wealth.
Right. The GIUK gap, that's Greenland, Iceland, UK, is absolutely essential here. During the Cold War, it was this critical NATO choke point for blocking Soviet subs. Controlling Greenland outright just locks that down completely.
But the modern angle is economic.
It's economic and industrial. The sources are clear that Greenland has massive reserves of rare earth elements, and those are vital for modern defense electronics.
Wait, let's connect the dots here. We're going to talk about the massive defense buildup later.
Mm-hmm.
That $151 billion Project Shield. To build that, you need a secure, non-Chinese source for those elements.
You've got it. That's the connection. The administration is currently, you know, heavily reliant on China for the critical inputs for the very electronics that will go into Project Shield.
So this Greenland push is really a supply chain issue.
It's a supply chain imperative dressed up as a geopolitical deterrent, exactly. And they're also leveraging the, quote, kinetic success of the Venezuela operation to signal that this isn't just talk. The threat of force over Greenland carries a lot more weight now than it would have a few weeks ago.
And the international backlash has been predictable. A massive fracture within NATO.
Huge. The Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, issued a really stark warning. She said a forceful annexation would be, quote, the end of the NATO military alliance.
That's existential language for a 75-year-old alliance.
It is. It suggests Denmark would pick its own sovereignty over the treaty's mutual defense clause.
And other European countries backed them up.
They did. In a rare show of unity, leaders from France, Germany, the UK, Poland, Italy, and Spain all put out a joint statement. They urged the US to respect Danish sovereignty and said very clearly Greenland belongs to its people.
What about Greenland itself? What's their response?
Well, they're trying to de-escalate. Greenland's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Vivian Motzfeldt, has requested an urgent meeting with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And then you have cultural figures like the Icelandic singer Björk urging Greenland to fight for independence and not trade one cruel colonizer for another.
Okay, so the Greenland situation is about a shift from diplomacy to military threat, all driven by an industrial need for resources. Let's move to that other kinetic event, Venezuela, and the fallout from Operation Absolute Resolve.
Right. The administration is still carefully managing the operational and legal aftermath of capturing President Maduro and Celia Flores on January 3rd.
And they're being very careful with their language.
Very careful. The operation involved Delta Force and CIA support, but it's consistently being labeled not as an act of war, but as a law enforcement action against indicted narco-terrorists.
But the scale of the operation makes that law enforcement claim pretty hard to accept, especially given the details the president himself revealed.
It does. I mean, he detailed a massive intervention. She mentioned 152 airplanes, a lot of boots on the ground, and maybe most alarmingly, turning off the electricity for almost the entire country.
Turning off the power for an entire country. I mean, even if you call it law enforcement, that's an unprecedented level of intervention in the region, isn't it?
Functionally, yes. It's not a surgical strike. It's an occupation-level intervention. And to reinforce that narrative, DHS released aerial footage on January 6th showing the Coast Guard and the newly named Department of War interdicting ships.
And the president's declared strategy is blunt.
Extremely blunt. He said, we're in charge of Venezuela and that they're enforcing an oil quarantine.
This has to be raising huge war powers concerns in Congress.
It is. The legal controversy is all about the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC. Top Senate Democrats say they still haven't received a formal OLC memo justifying the strike, which is absolutely standard procedure for something of this magnitude.
So what does that suggest?
Yeah.
That they're just bypassing the normal legal process?
It suggests the administration is relying on a really expanded unitary theory of Article II power, basically arguing the president's authority as commander-in-chief is enough to go capture indicted people anywhere in the world.
What did the UN's take?
The UN Human Rights Office immediately condemned it. They said the strike undermined international law and violated territorial integrity, full stop. They see it as a really dangerous precedent.
Meanwhile, inside Venezuela, the political situation is still a mess, even with Maduro gone.
It's a real political tightrope.
Uh-huh.
The vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, was sworn in as interim president. But the big problem is that Diosdado Cabello, who's a major political and military force and is also listed in the U.S. indictment, is still a huge player.
And what's interesting is that the U.S. isn't backing the Democratic opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado. Why not?
Well, they seem to view the whole previous strategy of backing opposition leaders like Guaido as a total failure. This new approach is purely transactional.
Transactional how?
The president has suggested that U.S. firms will eventually get paid back by developing Venezuela's oil reserves. He even talked about the U.S. reimbursing oil companies for their expenses to get them to invest now. The goal isn't democracy, it's controlling the oil.
That focus on fracturing regional influence that connects directly to the third big move from the executive branch, the pivot in the Middle East.
Yes. Secretary of State Marco Rubio orchestrating this massive realignment with the U.S.-Israel-Syria trilateral agreement.
This is a huge deal.
It's a diplomatic masterstroke designed entirely to isolate Iran. The State Department announced a joint fusion mechanism between the U.S., Israel, and Syria. And this came out of secret meetings in Paris with Jared Kushner and Tom Barrack.
A fusion mechanism between Israel and Syria.
I mean, that's historically unprecedented. What does this thing actually do?
Its mandate is very sensitive. First, it allows for direct intelligence sharing between Israeli and Syrian intelligence services.
Which would have been unthinkable a year ago.
Completely. Second, it sets up military de-escalation protocols to prevent accidental conflict. And third, and this is the most crucial part, it includes significant commercial incentives.
What kind of incentives are powerful enough to make President Assad flip on his biggest ally, Iran? Well, the sources strongly suggest the U.S. is offering major sanctions relief, maybe even reconstruction aid, to get Assad to decouple from the Iranian sphere. He's basically trading his security alliance with Tehran for economic survival.
So it's a wedge strategy.
Yeah.
How does it actually hurt Iran and its allies?
Operationally, it's a logistical nightmare for them. By giving the Assad regime a path to survival and economic reintegration, the U.S. and Israel are trying to get all Iranian military infrastructure kicked out of Syria.
And without Syria as a land bridge.
Hezbollah is isolated in Lebanon. It drastically reduces their ability to threaten Israel or operate regionally.
But the risks here are enormous for everyone.
Huge risks. Assad could be assassinated by Iranian proxies. The U.S. risks stabilizing a brutal dictator. And it's really destabilizing for Turkey, who sees this as a betrayal, and for Jordan. It's a massive geopolitical gamble.
And we should note, while all this was happening on January 6th, the White House was doing some deliberate counter-programming here at home.
Yes. On the fifth anniversary of the January 6th, 2021 Capitol attack, they completely ignored it. This follows the president granting blanket clemency last year to over 1,500 people convicted in relation to that event.
So instead of commemorating it?
He gave a speech to the House GOP retreat focused entirely on the 2026 agenda. And the White House launched a new webpage that day, explicitly blaming Democrats for having masterfully reversed reality about what happened in 2021. The message is, we're moving on.
Okay, that covers the international front. Let's connect this foreign policy to the institutional and fiscal changes happening at home. This takes us to the Department of War and the Treasury.
Right. And that name change from the Department of Defense to the Department of War, it's not just semantics. It's a major institutional shift. It signals a move to a footing of industrial mobilization, which Secretary Pete Hegseth is calling his Arsenal of Freedom initiative.
And the numbers behind this mobilization are just staggering. Give us the technical details on this.
The biggest piece is the funding vehicle for the U.S. Missile Defense Program, what some are calling the Golden Dome. We're getting details now on the $151 billion Scalable Homeland Innovative Enterprise Layer Defense, or SHIELD contract vehicle.
$151 billion. That's not a contract. That's an economic stimulus program. What kind of contract is it?
It's structured as a multiple award, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, or IDIQ vehicle. And it involves over 2,000 contractors across the entire industrial base.
So this SHIELD project is driving the immediate demand for key missile components.
It is. And complementing it is a landmark agreement with Lockheed Martin to more than triple the annual production of PAC-3 MSE interceptors. They want to hit 2,000 units per year by 2030. This is all driven by lessons from Ukraine and the perceived missile threat from China.
Now we can connect this directly back to Greenland. The defense funding is already flowing there, which just validates the whole acquisition strategy.
That's where the budget lines really tell the story. There's a separate but related $1.1 billion contract that was awarded to a company called Indyne Inc.
For what specifically?
For missile warning and space domain awareness services. And the contract specifically covers operations at Pacific Space Base in Greenland. This is so critical. The U.S. is already committing over $1 billion to operate a vital missile defense infrastructure on Greenlandic soil.
So the acquisition push is meant to eliminate the risk of Denmark saying no.
It's meant to eliminate sovereign risk and guarantee total U.S. control over a facility that is vital to the $151 billion SHIELD project.
Before we move on from the Department of War, there were some updates on military personnel and families.
Right. Secretary Hegseth has directed a review of women's effectiveness in ground combat roles, signaling a potential shift back towards prioritizing physical standards over integration goals.
And the Military Family Advisory Network is doing its biennial survey.
Yes, their work is crucial. It's the largest independent research effort on military families, and it's led to major reforms in the past, especially around housing. This year, they're really focused on financial stress.
Their last study had a shocking statistic about food insecurity.
It did. 51% of respondents reported food insecurity at some point. That's an astonishing number.
So how are they following up on that?
It led to programs like their 1 Million Meals Challenge. And this year, they've added new questions to look at the link between online gambling, financial stress, and social isolation. They're trying to see if the military lifestyle is pushing families toward high-risk behaviors that just make things worse.
Okay, that gives us the human cost of the Department of War. Let's shift to the Treasury Department, where Secretary Scott Bessent is operationalizing the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or OBBA. This is being described as a dual decoupling.
It is. It's a dual assertion of sovereignty. First, decoupling the tax code to favor specific domestic groups, and second, decoupling the U.S. corporate tax base from international oversight.
Let's start with the domestic side, the working families' tax cuts. What are the specific numbers we need for the archive?
So Treasury released the permanent inflation-adjusted tax brackets for 2026. The key populace change is a plus 4% adjustment for the bottom two brackets. So for single filers, the 10% rate now covers income up to $12,400, and the 12% rate goes up to $50,400. The top rate is still 37%, but it kicks in over $640,600.
And beyond the brackets, there's that targeted relief for tip and overtime earners. That's a huge political signal.
It's a profound shift. Treasury confirmed the elimination of federal income tax on tip income. It's a deduction of up to $25,000. And crucially, it phases out for people with a modified adjusted gross income, or MAGI, over $150,000.
So it's very targeted. And the overtime deduction?
It's similar. A targeted deduction of up to $12,500. Again, with phase outs for higher earners, this is a political weapon, you know, designed to reward hourly wage growth.
Then there are the new Trump accounts, the tax advantage savings vehicles for kids. What are the specifics there?
They're for children born between January 1st, 2025 and December 31st, 2028. The federal government puts in a one-time $1,000 pilot contribution, but the real engine is supposed to be employers.
How so?
Employers can contribute up to $2,500 a year for an employee's dependent, and that amount is excludable from the employee's taxable income, kind of like an HSA. The total annual contribution is capped at $5,000.
Okay, now let's get to the international side of this, which might be the most aggressive move of all, rejecting the OECD global minimum tax.
It is. Secretary Bessent announced the U.S. secured a sovereignty carve-out, and that exempts U.S.-headquartered multinational companies from the OECD's Pillar 2 15% global minimum tax. He called it a victory against extraterritorial overreach.
So Pillar 2 was supposed to stop companies from shifting profits to tax havens. If the U.S. just carves itself out, what happens to that whole framework?
Well, the practical impact is that it preserves the full value of U.S. R&D credits, which the OECD rules would have diluted. But by exempting the world's largest corporate tax base, the administration has basically rendered the global minimum tax unenforceable as a universal standard.
So it's a definitive return to global tax competition.
Absolutely. The U.S. is signaling that it's going to use its tax code to compete, not to cooperate. And Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee are praising it for protecting American tax sovereignty.
Okay, that covers the massive shifts at the executive and Treasury. Let's broaden out to the regulatory agencies, starting with Health and Human Services.
Right. At HHS, Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. revised the childhood immunization schedule based on a presidential memorandum. It's a direct intervention to align the U.S. schedule with Denmark's.
So we need a clear structural analysis here. What are the core differences between the crowded U.S. schedule and the Danish one?
The U.S. schedule has up to 21 immunizations before age one. The Danish approach is very different. They start later, at 3 months, they space them out more, and they focus on infections with a high risk of death or serious harm.
So what routine U.S. vaccines are being omitted under this new guidance?
Several that are standard here. Vaccines for RSV, rotavirus, varicella, that's chickenpox, seasonal flu, COVID-19, and hepatitis A.
But the experts are warning that this is a dangerous comparison. It's about the structural differences between the two countries, isn't it?
Precisely. This comparison totally ignores the huge differences in our healthcare and social safety nets. Denmark has universal healthcare, but most importantly, they have generous, universal paid sick leave.
Right, like if a Danish kid gets chickenpox, the parents can actually afford to stay home and contain the spread.
Exactly. But in the U.S., where paid sick leave isn't guaranteed for millions and most people live paycheck to paycheck, what happens? Workers show up sick. So if you adopt the Danish schedule here, you risk more disease spreading rapidly through workplaces and schools.
Okay, moving from vaccines to welfare programs. HHS also took punitive action against some Democratic-led states, citing fraud.
This is a direct response to that massive welfare scandal in Minnesota. HHS froze childcare and family assistance grants in 5 states: Minnesota, New York, California, Illinois, and Colorado.
And what are the dollar amounts we're talking about?
It's a lot of money. The freeze involves $7 billion for TNF, which is welfare, nearly $2.4 billion for the Child Care Development Fund, and about $870 million for social services grants.
And this is all happening in the context of that Minnesota scandal, where up to $9 billion was allegedly stolen, and we're expecting 2,000 federal agents to be deployed there.
The political fallout is already huge. The Democratic governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, just announced he won't seek re-election because of it. It's a massive federal-state flashpoint.
And there's another welfare accountability mandate from the OBBBA, this one for Medicaid.
Yes, the community engagement requirement. It's a new federal mandate. By December 2026, states have to verify 80 hours of work or qualifying activities each month for people on Medicaid expansion.
That is an incredibly tight deadline. Why is this so hard for states to implement?
Because they're struggling. They have no formal guidance yet from CMS, and they have to build entirely new data sharing systems to connect Medicaid, SNAP, and TNF records to verify compliance. That kind of tech infrastructure is really complex and expensive to build.
So they're turning to technology to avoid what they call member abrasion, basically kicking eligible people off the rolls by mistake.
Right. The tech firms are building a 5-tier automated verification system. The key is that if someone is already verified through SNM or TNF, they're automatically considered in compliance for Medicaid. That eliminates a lot of the paperwork that could trip people up.
This theme of data consolidation leads us right to the next topic: Palantir Technologies and its rapidly growing federal contracts.
Palantir's federal footprint almost doubled in 2025, up to $970.5 million. This really cemented their financial standing.
Let's focus on that controversial contract with ICE, especially with the administration's mass deportation efforts.
So Palantir has a $30 million contract with ICE to build an Immigration Lifestyle Operating System, or Immigration OS. It's designed to track deportations and help target people for arrests. And the key detail in the contract is that Palantir will use external sources in addition to the usual government data.
That phrase, external sources, is what has lawmakers so worried about a mega database.
It is. They're afraid the system will pull in data from consumer databases, social media, maybe even other federal agencies like the IRS or Social Security. You combine all that and you create this incredibly powerful digital ID on millions of people.
And the concern isn't just about data collection. It's about how the system itself becomes a form of policymaking.
Exactly. Data scientists argue that how you architect an AI system, how it assigns risk scores, how it flags people, is policymaking. And they're warning that even with a low error rate, when you're processing millions of records, you could still have thousands of people facing detention or deportation because of an algorithmic mistake.
Okay, that's a huge slate of executive actions. Let's pivot now to the legislative branch, to Congress, where they're trying to check, or in some cases, enable all of this while operating on a razor-thin margin.
Right. The Senate came back to these high-stakes personnel battles, acting as the gatekeeper for some of the administration's controversial national security nominees.
Let's run through the confirmation votes. They're pretty revealing.
For CIA General Counsel Joshua Simmons was confirmed 53-47, a very narrow party-line vote. Then Sarah Bailey was confirmed as the director of the Drug Control Office, ONDCP, by a vote of 52-48.
That one was even closer. There was a notable Republican defection from Senator Rand Paul.
There was. Paul joined the Democrats, showing that the Libertarian wing is really uneasy with the administration's militarized approach to the drug war. But Bailey has a complex profile. She also supports medical marijuana legalization, which probably kept a few moderate Democrats from voting against her.
And beyond personnel, the Senate is trying to impose some fiscal discipline, which has to create some internal conflict within the GOP, given the defense spending we just discussed.
This is the internal check. The Senate passed the National Landslide Preparedness Act, but only after adding an amendment from Senator Rick Scott of Florida. That amendment required funding offsets and deficit reduction provisions.
So what's the significance of adding that to a bill about landslides?
It signals that while the fiscal hawks in the Senate GOP might support the massive spending on the Department of War and Project Shield, They are absolutely going to enforce fiscal discipline on all non-defense discretionary spending. It's setting the stage for a huge budget war down the road.
And Democrats are using the upcoming funding deadlines to try and put a check on the administration's foreign policy.
They are. The funding deadline for the defense appropriations bill is January 30th. And Senate Democrats, like Kaine and Merkley, are threatening to add language that would restrict the use of funds for military operations in Venezuela or intervention in Cuba and Colombia.
So while the Senate is focused on fiscal checks, the House is pushing the administration's deregulatory agenda.
Yes, the House Rules Committee advanced two specific deregulatory bills on January 6th, both aimed at federal energy efficiency mandates.
Let's talk about the Shower Act. This seems like a classic example.
It is. H.R. 4593, the Shower Act, changes the technical definition of a shower head. It adopts the ASME definition, which allows each nozzle in a multi-head shower system to be treated separately for water flow. It's a legislative reversal of a 2021 Biden-era rule.
So while the fate of NATO hangs in the balance, the House GOP is fighting for better water pressure.
That's one way to put it. The other bill is H.R. 5184, the Affordable Homes Act. This one prohibits the Secretary of Energy from enforcing energy efficiency standards on manufactured housing. The argument is that the mandates drive up the initial purchase price for low-income buyers.
And the political math behind all of this in Congress is just incredibly tight right now, especially in the House.
It's historically slim. After the death of Rep. LaMalfa and the resignation of Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the current composition is 218 Republicans and 214 Democrats.
Which leaves Speaker Mike Johnson with, what, one vote to spare?
Literally one. He can only afford one GOP defection on any party line vote until the special elections happen. This hyper-thin majority dictates everything they do.
And this is likely what prompted President Trump's very direct warning to House Republicans at their retreat.
It was. He told them, quote, "You got to win the midterms, because if we don't win the midterms, they'll find a reason to impeach me." He's directly linking his own political survival to their success in November.
And finally, there's the ongoing fight over the expired ACA subsidies, which is causing massive premium hikes.
Premiums are already going up by 26% to 35% for about 22 million Americans. The legislative logjam is the Hyde Amendment. Top Republicans insist on adding new restrictions to prevent federally subsidized plans from covering abortion services.
But the president urged them to be flexible on that, which caused immediate backlash from his own base.
He told them, "Now you have to be a little flexible on Hyde." And the head of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America immediately called it an abandonment of a decades-long commitment and warned it would cost them the election.
Okay, that covers the executive and legislative branches. But hanging over all of this is the judicial branch.
Yeah.
Let's move to the Supreme Court.
Right. And the single biggest check on the administration's domestic power came from that December 23rd Supreme Court ruling in Trump v. Illinois. This ruling really defined the limits of federalism.
What exactly did that 6-3 ruling establish?
It was about the president's attempt to federalize the Illinois and Texas National Guards to use them for ICE interior enforcement against the will of the governors. The 6-3 majority, which was a really interesting mix of justices, blocked the action. They held that the statute in question did not authorize the president to commandeer state militias for domestic law enforcement in this way.
So it was a massive federalism firewall. What was the immediate impact?
It was swift. Just a few days later, on December 31st, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals used that exact precedent to order the immediate end of the federalization of the California National Guard. The court essentially said, the Supreme Court has spoken.
And looking ahead, the Supreme Court is about to rule on several other huge cases that could define the limits of executive power.
First, we're waiting on the ruling on the Liberation Day tariffs. The legal question is whether national security statutes can be used to bypass Congress's taxing authority. A ruling against the administration could blow a huge hole in the Treasury's revenue projections.
Then there's the question of agency independence.
That's Trump v. Slaughter, which is about the president's power to remove the FTC commissioner. And what's really interesting is that during oral arguments, Justice Kagan's Crossling hinted that even she might be willing to align with the conservatives to restrict the administrative state. If that happens, it would open the door to much greater executive control over agencies like the SEC and the FCC.
And finally, a major social issue is coming up.
Yes. On January 13th, the court will hear arguments in Little v. Hecox, which is a challenge to Idaho's ban on biological males in women's sports. It's setting the stage for a major equal protection ruling.
Before we wrap, is there anything else we should add about the appropriations process?
Just that the House Rules Committee did move forward with a big omnibus package for commerce, justice, science, and other agencies. It's an attempt to clear the decks before that January 30th deadline so they can focus on the administration's newer priorities, like, you know, funding the Venezuela occupation and the Greenland push.
But even that is causing friction.
It is. The senators from Colorado are objecting because they want language protecting the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which the OMB is threatening to dismantle as part of its push to cut non-defense spending. It just shows how intense the fighting is over every dollar.
So if we pull back from all these details, what's the overarching strategy here? What's the common thread?
It's what we're calling the sovereignty doctrine, and every single action fits into it. First, you have the assertion of economic sovereignty. That's the rejection of the OECD tax framework. The U.S. is betting it can dictate terms to the rest of the world.
Second, territorial sovereignty.
Right. That's the Greenland ultimatum and the Venezuela operation. It's valuing direct physical control over critical geography oil in Venezuela, the GIUK gap and minerals in Greenland, over maintaining traditional alliances like NATO.
Then the internal friction is the check on that ambition.
That's the clash between the administration's claim to executive sovereignty and the judiciary's defense of state sovereignty and federalism. Trump v. Illinois shows the White House is winning the battle for external power, but facing real constitutional checks on internal consolidation.
So what about the long-term sustainability of all this? We're talking about a $151 billion contract for Project Shield, another billion for just one base in Greenland.
It's a fiscal ticking time bomb. The arsenal of freedom strategy requires massive defense spending, but at the same time, Treasury is enacting populist tax cuts that reduce federal revenue. And the fiscal hawks in the Senate have already shown they're going to enforce deficit reduction on non-defense spending.
Which sets up a huge internal clash within the party.
A monumental one.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? I mean, if the administration is committed to this incredibly high-cost, unilateral arsenal of freedom strategy, how is that sustainable financially? The budget math just doesn't seem to close. So how will they navigate that inevitable political war when the fiscal hawks in their own party try to balance the books? Will non-defense agencies just be starved to fund these global ambitions, risking our own domestic stability for geopolitical dominance? That's the question we leave you to think about.
An administration moving at maximum velocity in every domain, but facing growing friction over who pays the bill and, you know, whose authority is ultimately supreme.
That's it for this exhaustive deep dive into the federal activity of January 6th and 7th, 2026.
We hope this archival record provides the context needed for understanding this definitive inflection point.
We'll see you next time.